This is Whitley Strieber, and you have made a courageous choice. You're listening to Dreamland, a truly free, non-commercial voice on the internet. And from 22,500 miles in the sky on 1.FM and the Global Star Communications Radio Network, we say it like it is. We take you where others will not take you. Dreamland, welcome to the edge of the world. This week for our subscribers, Jim Mars talks to Chris Jones about why Otto Rahn's book Crusade for the Grail remained unpublished in English for 70 years. What secrets does it contain?
From Nashville, this is William Henry filling in for Whitley Strieber. This is Dreamland. Welcome, everyone. Many believe we are living in the end times, also called the messianic times, and millions anticipate cataclysmic changes in the arrival of a Christ figure. There are widely divergent theories about how this will manifest. Hindus, for example, believe that whenever profound evil spreads widely throughout the earth, the Supreme Being comes to earth in the form of a human person in order to uproot vice and to establish virtue so that the earth may get rid of sinners. Teilhard de Chardin said that during times of universal distress, archetypes of wholeness are released from the collective, deep mind, in order to reconstitute the fragments into wholeness. Some believe that the Messiah or Christ will only come when the world is so debased and degenerate that it's on the verge of collapse. Others believe that Christ comes through the effort and dedicated preparation of humans who heroically raise and hold their spiritual vibration until the entire world attains a higher consciousness. The result of this effort is the emergence or appearance of a being that embodies all of these characteristics, and all who dedicate themselves to raising their spiritual frequency are the heralds of this being. The long-awaited ones may be us. So what are we waiting for? Is there a definitive sign of the imminent appearance of this degenerate civilization or its higher harmonic, the age of Christ consciousness? In the view of our guest today, John Hoag, one sign we are awaiting is the appearance of the last pope. We may not have long to wait, says John, because presently we are in the presence of the second-to-last pope. His recently released ebook, The Last Pope Revisited, available at HoagProphecy.com, reassesses the papal succession prophecies of St. Malachy. After the death of John Paul II in 2005, there remains only Benedict XVI and one more pope before the apocalypse. What really is waiting beyond the doors of doomsday? Let's ask John. John, welcome to Dreamland.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, William. That was a great opening. It really covered a lot of ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for taking time. You know, John, we hear one of the world's great experts on this whole question of the last pope. The papacy claims not only to possess the keys of heaven, but also to rule the earth. But there's also this list of popes that ends with a last pope named Petrus Romanus that also represents the end of the Catholic Church. So tell us what's going on with this whole idea of the last pope.
Well, it all began reportedly in 1139-1140 AD when St. Malachy, an Irish saint, came on a pilgrimage to Rome. And when he mounted the Janiculum Hill and oversaw Rome in the evening, he had a ecstatic trance wherein he started mumbling these mottos, 111 two-to-three-word Latin phrases that, with a coda at the end, a short prophecy about Petrus Romanus, Peter of Rome, as the final pope. And it was supposed to be the succession of pontiffs unto that day of the great testing tribulation, the Catholic version of the apocalypse, which is really a little different from the Protestant. It focuses more on the apostasy of the church going through a degradation, actually being taken over by the satanic forces and having false popes. And then being restored through great tribulations of the apocalypse to become the church of the world. That is the mainstream idea, the Vatican-approved prophecy. But what my book deals with also is that there are two kinds of prophets in the Catholic Church. There are the more renegade prophets that view a future that is far different, one that may not require a church for the dispensation of the divine light to the people of Earth after the apocalypse. But before we get into that, a little more on Malachi's prophecies. Up until the 1590s, it was not known that they existed. They had been rediscovered, quote-unquote, by Adam Arnold Weon, who was a historian of Benedictine histories, who wrote the Lignum Vitae, his huge 1,800-word book, which is only pretty much remembered by anyone outside of Catholic scholarship for a sandwiching of a couple pages in its vast tome listing these prophecies, which Dom Weon mistook for coming from a Benedictine Saint Malachi of Ireland. He was a Cistercian, not a Benedictine monk. But anyway, of the first 76 mottos that you see are almost miraculously fulfilled up to the 1590s, where the clues that there's basically about 11 clues that one follows in deciphering these mottos. Sometimes it will be describing a place where the person was born. It might describe their Christian name at birth before they became Pope. It might even describe their name as Pope. It will often apply the details of the heraldry of the Pope, either as a cardinal or the city where the cardinal served, or as the coat of arms of the Pope during his reign. Heraldry plays very strongly in the papacy. And so most of the clues are about heraldry.
And John, what I'm wondering is, where did these clues come from? Did this prophet go into an ecstatic state of trance, perhaps, or was it just direct channeling? Where do you suppose this emerged from?
Well, it is a question, a good question, but there's a deeper question that I'm getting to. First off, is, are these actually prophecies from St. Malachi?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's a little suspicious is that all the clues, all the basic clues, can be found for the first 76 that had already happened by the time of the 1590s.
Mm-hmm.
So then that leaves 36 or so left of the mottos and the prophetic coda. That if this is a forgery, or if it's a forgery and a fraud, then like so many forgeries and frauds in prophecy, which are numerous, at the time of its publication, its accuracy record should fall flat on its face. And what is remarkable about this prophecy is the remaining 36 mottos that have now been fulfilled. The last motto was the current Pope. Now we only have the paragraph that ends the prophecy left to be fulfilled by the Pope after Benedict XVI. It's that it has an accuracy record, which I'll show in the e-book. There's two ways of looking at the accuracy. You can look at it a more liberal way and a more harsh judgment. But even in the harshest judgment, it's in the upper 70% tile range of accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a little more liberal with how you apply it, it's upwards to 90%. In either case, you, especially with the harder judgment, anything that you have in prophecy that gets into the 70 percentile range is remarkable,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of prophecy is not written in stone. Prophecies tend to change the future as much as predict the future if they become popular. If they warn enough people of changes, they can be a form of propagation to direct people to a better life because, for instance, all the predictions about the millennium bug disaster that was going to come when computers switched over to a double zero in the year 2000, had there been enough hue and cry in prophetic circles that it became a popular subject in the media, and that did have a major part in pushing people to fix it. So
mm-hmm.
in a way, that's a successful prophecy. a prophecy of doom that never happened because people heeded it and changed their ways in the present. So for a set of prophecies to be in the upper 70 percentile is one of the greatest prophetic successes in history. Now, the fact that it's not completely 100% anymore is a strong evidence that this was not written by St. Malachi, but mm-hmm. somebody who wrote under his pseudonym, some mysterious person in the Renaissance period, no later than the 1570s. And the reason why we know that is that there's a few telling evidences. Some of the heraldry that the man is predicting about the previous popes comes from a fraudulent source that was published in 1577 or so. So the Epitome, which had mistakes in the heraldry of certain popes, that's a pretty damning finger that it was the first 76 or a prefabricated thing. But I would not jump quickly to a judgment that the man was deceiving people, because if you look deeper in the history of prophecy, you will find that many seers wrote under the names of other greater seers before them. There's at least three Isaiahs in the book of Isaiah. The style and language is completely different. Mm-hmm. There are a couple Zechariahs. There could be dozens of Daniels. It was considered all right. It was considered an honor to do that. And I think this man was not trying to deceive people, but he was trying to get a message out to the world that if he had been openly his own prophet, he might have been burned at the stake for it.
And so is this a prophecy then, or is it in fact a blueprint for what is to come? What do you think about the use of prophecy? I mean, you've kind of hinted at that already, is that it offers a scenario of possibility, but what if there is an organization that views prophecy such as this and the Book of Revelation and others as actual agendas of something that is to be manifested?
Well, that is the other aspect of what I call propaganda, which is mm-hmm. a word I coined in my book, Messiahs. Which looked at many of things in your preamble, was really, that was what my book was about, of what is really happening. Is there some, are there groups that are trying to perpetuate an idea, a concept? And I think every of the at least 33 or so major and minor messianic religions, in the world, from East, West, pagan, native, you name it, all share a view that their take on what's going to happen apocalyptically, and I mean that in the truth sense of the word, a revelation of light and enlightenment, they all feel openly or covertly that their view is the one that will happen, or they hope that's the one that will happen, and all the other views from all the other messianic religions are either misinterpreting the signs or are false. And so there is, especially in the Western religions, a very strong situation. For instance, the Vatican literally censors and approves which prophecies are right and wrong before they've been fulfilled. and talk about controlling the future.
Right.
The Vatican has the Curia and the popes and his cabinet have, for many successions, have been doing this. The fact that the third secret of Fatima had taken so long to be revealed, when indeed the messenger, the apparition of Mary, if you will, that told Sister Lucia to put out that third secret no later than 1960. It was a very clear message. She made that statement in the 40s.
Wow.
And look what happened. It was read by every pope, but nobody released it until just recently. Towards the end of the last pope, previous pope's reign, John Paul II. And then what was released was actually not, had elements about it that were already known about the prophecy that were missing. So it's very suspicious that there was some, finagling going on by the man who was responsible for releasing it, who is now the pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, around Benedict the 16th. So there's definitely a lot of politics in messianic prophecy. For instance, in Islam right now, there was an amazing massacre that went on at the approaches of Najaf just a few months ago, where a group ran in of Shia cultists who believed their leader was the Imam, the Mahdi, was the kind of the Islamic version of the Second Coming, clashed with other Shias on the way to Najaf, the holy city, and had a big battle over it. Didn't get spoken of much in mainstream press, but there's a very strong feeling in Israel as well as in the Islamic world that these dire times, this brinkmanship of war in the Gulf and all that, is precursor to the appearance of, if you're a Muslim, the 12th Imam or the Mahdi, who liberate the world and make it Islamic, restore the great religious caliphate, restore Jerusalem to Islam. And then there's also people, my Israeli sources, who are waiting and believe that they're living in the time of the Masiha, the coming of the Messiah, which, to understand the term, the closest approximation of anything that's a Messiah in our world is the Dalai Lama. That is a king of a country who is also the temporal and religious king, a messenger of a country. And the Jewish people are waiting for their Dalai Lama from the line of David to return now. And in all of this, there's a lot of politics, and a lot of, to get back on track with your question, I think, is their prophecy has often been used as a propaganda element to make a future happen, or to suppress a future that is foreseen by others that don't follow the mainstream view. And it has been my work through the last 30 years to grab all those people thrown to the sidelines by mainstream prophecy and let them have their voice, because time and again, these proven prophets who are rebels really see what's coming, because the mainstream has never gotten it right about religious transformation. If they'd gotten it right, why didn't Caiaphas become a disciple of Christ? If they had gotten it right, why didn't all the Arab animists become disciples of Muhammad rather than fight him? If for 1,000 years the Buddhists, the Hindus had foreseen the place where the next avatar of their teaching would restore and renovate Hinduism and Brahmanism, when he indeed was born in Bihar and became Gautama the Buddha, why did they try to poison him several times? Because he didn't follow their idea. They thought he would just make people more fundamentally Hindu. He ended up saying everybody's a Brahmin, everybody's a spiritual being beyond caste who can attain to the truth. That was heresy to the mainstream. They tried to destroy him. But he was fulfilling their prophecy that had been 1,000 years old.
John, we have to take a quick break. When we get back, I want to talk about the Vatican. I want to get back to the Vatican for a moment and its view on the St. Malachi prophecy. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
John Hope's astonishing book, The Last Pope, has been rewritten and revised with all kinds of new material. It's available from HogueProphecy.com for just $7. That's right, a downloadable electronic version PDF file available for $7 from HogueProphecy.com. Last week, our subscribers got to talk personally with Dr. Lynn Katai about her experience of the Phoenix Lights. Upcoming soon. Marla Free's one of the most powerful mediums I've ever met, and you've never heard of her. She'll be talking personally to our subscribers, and then one of the great astrologers of our time, Mahala Gale, will be with us too. Don't miss a single week in the UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. Subscribe today. Go to UnknownCountry.com. Click on that subscribe tab. We need you if we're going to keep this going, and you need us.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with John Hogue. John, just before the break, we were talking about how these rebel prophets are the ones that seem to get it right, and the mainstream doesn't seem to get it at all. And you cited some very good examples of that. What I'm wondering, is, which is a follow-up to our early conversation, is how are the prophecies of St. Malachi viewed inside the Vatican? Are they well-known? Does the Vatican officially accept or reject these prophecies? Or are there signs that they're saying one thing and doing something else?
It's the final. They're saying one thing and doing something else. And I'll give you some examples. When John Paul II was dying, by the way, his motto in Latin is De Laboris Solis, which means in medieval Latin, the sun's eclipse, the sun's labor. A laboring sun, that is a darkening sun, is a sun giving birth to itself, i.e., it is an eclipse. They knew already that this is a remarkable motto, because out of 111 mottos that have been fulfilled, only one pope had been born under the sign of an eclipse. That was John Paul II. Now, when he died and the process of mourning was finished and internment was established, it was around, I think, April 8th of 2005, was the scheduled day for the internment of John Paul into his tomb underneath the Bernini altar in the Vatican, the most choice tomb for the greatest popes, of which there's only room for one more. Just hold on that thought as we...
Which is incredible, right.
Yeah. Now, remember, don't believe publicly in the prophecies of St. Malachi, but when you have a chance to stop a prophecy from being fulfilled, that is, the 8th of April was clearly noted as another day of an eclipse. If I was saying to people that I will know for sure if the Vatican in its actions beyond its public PR really is obsessed with these prophecies, if they avoid interning this pope in at the time of an eclipse, because then they really closed the whole circle. The labor of the sun, born in 1920 under a solar eclipse, is entombed into the Vatican, into the St. Peter's Basilica, on a solar eclipse.
Amazing. John, what I want to know is, what's going on in your household while this is going on? You have to just be absolutely riveted. What kept you from going to Rome and wanting to see this firsthand?
Well, that is the wonder of our time. Is this revolution in media. Mm-hmm. I did see it. I was there. It was in two dimensions. I saw it in real time. I watched Catholic cable stations, which ran it real time without any ads. And I was up all night watching it from beginning to end, the ceremonies. And I opened the Last Pope Revisited with an account of how I watched what was going on and how other people... The millions of people that were crowding the streets during the internment ceremony also viewed what I was viewing on vast LC screens, showing except for the chosen few, the dignitaries, and the few in the front rows in the Vatican Palazzo. There's not going to be many people who are going to actually see it firsthand, and in our world, one need not see that. One can see it on CNN. Mm-hmm. So, but with that said, I also, when watching it, I get into a meditative space, and you might say that in the pathways of consciousness, one need only close one's eyes or silence the mind to be in the same place anyone else in the physical world is. I mean, they call it sometimes remote viewing, but this is more a thing of the heart, a thing of you can feel your way, if you know the knack, to have your consciousness be in a presence at a place, to be available to experience it. And certainly it is aided by the fact is if you're doing this, sitting in a state of meditation watching the actual thing on TV, you can do that. And since I've been to Italy and been to many of these places, I have in my psychic marking the die cast of those places. So I can be there, you know. It's hard to explain in temporal sense, but it's mm-hmm. it's really nothing too amazing. It's something everybody can do.
Sure.
It's a very mundane thing, but we make it sound like it's really amazing, but it isn't. It's more amazing that we put so much energy into efforts conditioned to us from birth time on throughout our lives to fight to divide ourselves from this state.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what tremendous energy will be released in the world when at last people stop being so predictable and stop being programmed to repeat the past and call it the future. That will be the end of prophecy. I foresee an end to prophecy because prophecy works because people are robotic and predictable. When that's broken, and there's a lot of indications in prophecy that a lot of prophecy gets very vague in the coming 1,000 years, in the coming few centuries even. And one of the reasons is that I theorize is that, one, we've either destroyed the world in ourselves, or we have seen that our past has betrayed us and our programming has betrayed us, and we have created ourselves anew as a human race. And that race will live more in the eternity of the present and therefore be more unpredictable and spontaneous.
Well said. So we're watching these events unfold in real time on CNN. And then all of a sudden, the talk starts to turn to, okay, well, who is going to follow on from John Paul II? Walk us through this process here and how it connects with the prophecies of St. Malachi.
Well, I was amazed to hear over the last few years, because, of course, of the long and lingering slow decline of John Paul II, talk about who was going to be the next pope probably was the longest period in papal history where people were considering who's going to be next, who are the papabili, the ones most likely to be popes. Usually what happens is those papabili are the first to be laughed off the map because, in fact, no cardinal even likes to be called a possible pope because it's almost like a curse that you for sure will never be pope.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1998, when I wrote the print version, a longer print version of my first edition on the subject of St. Malachi, it seemed to me that one of the highest chances would be somebody coming from Milan, mainly because the next pope was going to have the motto "Di Gloria Olive," which means the glory from the glory of the olive, which implies the olive branch of peace. It implies a number of things. The olive is leaves and branches are also a part of the symbology of Israel. The olive drab uniforms of the IDF. It is also the olive vines and branches are on the heraldry of the archbishopric of Milan, which is often where many popes are positioned by a living pope to be. Here's my next candidate. At the mm-hmm. time, early on when John Paul II was elected pope, he appointed Cardinal Martini as the Archbishop of Milan. He, in 2002, retired and was replaced by Tetamanzi, a very odd name. It means bull's tits. So people started to think, oh, well, he's replaced what is a very progressive cardinal, erudite cardinal, with a very right-wing cardinal. And then what also got us going, people were thinking about the next pope, is that Martini retired to Jerusalem to continue his canon law studies. He's quite a scholar and written many interesting books on canon law. And people were going, aha, see, now he's even in Jerusalem, in Israel, the land of the olive branch. And so that got people going to thinking that he must be the next pope. Of course, what actually happened in the papal conclave, where the cardinals, the College of Cardinals, are sealed away into the Sistine Chapel and an adjacent living quarters, until they can choose a pope. And they do this by paper ballots that are strung on a string so they won't be misplaced and recounted and then put into a furnace. And if they have chosen the pope by a majority, they put some chemical in it so that a little stovepipe coming out of the Sistine Chapel roof will belch out white smoke for choosing a pope, black smoke for we weren't able to choose a pope. So the whole world, that stovepipe in April was probably the most televised stovepipe in history, as everybody was waiting, and they had trouble with the smoke. It was coming out black and white, and so that often is part of the tradition that no one really quite knows for sure until the great bells of St. Peter's begin to ring. That means they have a pope. Now, in the first ballot, it was leaked out to the Italian press afterwards, and in the first ballot, Cardinal Martini got the majority of votes, but not enough to win the pontificacy. And then after that, all the votes built more and more around Cardinal Ratzinger, who then became Benedict the 16th. Now, it's very interesting to note that where does Benedict in De Gloria Olivae fit in that motto? In an amazing way, which makes me think that, once again, even though officially they don't like to talk about the Malachi prophecies as being for real, here is a pope bending over backwards to fit with the prophecies. This is the same man who, as the dean of the College of Cardinals, ran the funerary processions and organizations for John Paul II. He is the man that chose John Paul to be buried during a solar eclipse. He later became the man who would be and was the pope. And he takes the term Benedict. It is based on the Benedictines, the first order of monks in the 5th century that were ever established. And he's not a Benedictine by discipline, but he loved St. Benedict and called upon him as his kind of his motto. He's going to try to restore peace and unite Europe, as the early Benedict did during another dark time for the Church in the Dark Ages. There is a subsect of the Benedictines that are called the Olivetans. Hmm. Now, their job is to bring on the, to prepare the world for the prophecies that Jesus gave during his Mount of Olives sermon in the New
John,
Testament.
John, we have to take a quick break. Let this be an appropriate time. When we come back, let's get into that prophecy on the Mount of Olives, because it's absolutely key with what many prophecy watchers are looking at today. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
Howdy. This is Jim Mars, and I'm speaking today with Christopher Jones, the translator of the Otto Rahn book, Crusade Against the Grail. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't tell you how excited I am. I was. When I found out that there was an English translation of Otto Rahn's book.
He's talking about the legendary quest for the Grail that inspired Hitler's efforts to find the Holy Grail and the secret powers within it, and Otto Skorzeny's mysterious 1944 trip to Rahn-le-Château, where he telegraphed back to Berlin, "Mission successful." What did he mean? Listen to this fascinating interview with Chris Jones by Jim Mars in our subscriber section. Click on that subscribe tab today. Join us. It's well worth it. You know, William Henry is one of the best in the world at what he does, among the very most knowledgeable in the world. And the William Henry store on unknowncountry.com is an extremely special place. You get discounts on all of William Henry's great, hard-to-get books, unpublished, not available in bookstores, not available on Amazon, but available from the unknowncountry.com store. Ark of the Christos, don't miss it. It relates directly to what he's talking about today, and so many other exciting books and DVDs, and every DVD beautifully, professionally mastered. An exciting journey with William Henry. Go to the William Henry store on unknowncountry.com right now.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with John Hogue. John, just before the break, we got into the very interesting and key subject of the Mount of Olives prophecy. Let's talk about that.
Yes, the story goes that the disciples were with Jesus and looking at the temple, the great temple of Herod's temple, the great source, the Mecca of Judaism at the time. And he basically said that it would be destroyed. And they later walked up from the Mount of Olives and sat down to rest. And then he wanted to explain further what he was talking about. They wanted to ask him what that meant. And you can find it in Matthew. There's a number of things, but the main part that of interest I'd like to talk about would be Matthew 24, verse 6 through 8, where Jesus says, "The time is coming when you will hear the noise of battle near at hand, and the news of battles far away. See that you are not alarmed. Such things are bound to happen, but the end is still to come. For nation will make war upon nation, kingdom upon kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in many places. With all these things, the birth pangs of a new age begin." Now, a Pope Benedict, for many, many years, the Benedictines had their own prophecy. And again, here's another prophecy that the Catholic Church does not officially respect, but it's still there. A renegade prophecy for 1,000 years or so, that at the end of time, when the final popes would be there before the apocalypse, you would have a Benedictine pontiff. Now, Cardinal Ratzinger is not a Benedictine, but he has taken on their patron saint's name as pontiff. So one could say it is half fulfilled. You then add to that the Malachi prophecy, either written by St. Malachi or by a remarkable prophet from the 1590s, he says that it's from the glory of the olive. He is talking about the Olivetans. He is talking about the Olivetan Benedictines. We have a Pope Benedict the 16th. And the message then is that since this is the Pope that will see the beginning of the apocalyptic time that Jesus Christ was talking about in Matthew 24. We are entering the biblical evolutionary crisis now in this man's reign. Now, added to this is the concept that this pope would be viewed as a peacemaker. That's what a lot of interpreters of this motto thought. His first step in making peace between religions and ecumenicalism was an utter disaster. When his Regensburg speech, he basically threw out a quote, which I read the transcript of the speech, didn't seem to fit with even his whole talk about the melding of what made Christianity flourish in the world was that Jesus' spiritual message was addressed in the logic and tradition of philosophical Greeks. It was actually delivered. First time people heard the good news of Jesus Christ, it was delivered in Greek. But then he throws out this Islamophobic statement, unsubstantiated or qualified, and it sent a shockwave through the Middle East and through the Islamic world, where basically, once again, we have another crusading pope with a sweeping hand calling us all a bunch of violent fools or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that nothing is good in Islam but that which is, you know, how can you see anything good in Islam, with some paraphrasing the quote, if you convert by the sword, which actually is a good salvo to shoot across the bow of Islamic dogmatism. And unfortunately, if we were living more enlightened times, that would be the turn for the Islamic scholars to respond. And perhaps not only go beyond the fact that that is a dark shadow cast over Islamic religion, they could also turn around and say, well, what about the Crusader's sword that came into our lands and forcibly converted our people to your faith during your 11 some crusades over a few hundred years? with all that debate and encounter, which I think is a very necessary thing that must happen to hatch out these wounds into the air so they can dry and heal, I think there's a lot of stink that needs to come forth on all sides of religious thinking. And I was hopeful that by encountering, causing this catharsis, the Pope might make the next step and look at some of the things that Christianity has done, which has been quite bloodthirsty.
Right, and, let's give violent. Something back, right, yeah.
Yeah, but he didn't, and I predicted that he wouldn't. In the Hope Prophecy Bulletin that are free and available for anyone to see and archived at my website, I made a statement shortly after, I did a bulletin shortly after the Regensburg gaffe, and said, this is what's going to happen. He was scheduled to go in that November of 2006 to Turkey. And kind of a mixed fulfillment has happened so far in Benedict's reign. He did go there. He did pacify all the hubbub and conundrums that happened with his statement. He did a lot of nice gestures. He went to the mosque of Hagia Sophia. He prayed facing Mecca and the adjacent mosque, the Blue Mosque adjacent to Hagia Sophia, which really impressed the Islamic scholars. He did a lot to just say, that's not what I really meant and all. But basically, the mainstream is kind of left with this idea that, well, the Pope made a mistake, but he did a lot of healing and he kind of settled things down. So some scholars might say, well, there's Benedict being a peacemaker, just as the prophecy said he would. I take a view in the book a little more harsh on that, because I think it was just another example of what is a long tradition in the papacy, and that is the politics of apology, or the politics of a gesture that in itself is sentimental enough to distract people from what he's actually said. I'll give you an example. Why did not the Pope pray in Hagia Sophia or make some statement in a place that once was a great Christian church, the largest Christian church in the world, where thousands of people were martyred by rampaging Muslims back in Constantinople? Why didn't he have any words to say about his whole concept that he talked about at Regensburg? He avoided it. He went and prayed in the other mosque. Didn't have anything to say about it. I think it's a bit cowardly, but cloaked in platitudes of peace. But, you know, I still hold that in what will probably be the short reign of this Pope, that he will still do something. In fact, I think in the next few months there may be such dire actions going on in the Middle East, over Iran and Iraq, that he will be forced to be the great peacemaker, the go-between these factions. It's not looking too good at the moment, because last summer he was scheduled to come to Israel and visit Israel, which I think would have been a wonderful thing, but they decided they're not going to let the Pope be endangered by war until things settle down in the Middle East. That was the official Vatican announcement. Well, that's cowardly. Would Jesus Christ not go into the temple because he might hurt people's feelings if he threw over some tables with money changers? If this is the representative of Jesus Christ on earth, why is he such a coward?
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see him do, John? I mean, what is a concrete act that would proclaim him or allow people to recognize him as this peacemaker figure that you suggest he could be?
Well, It's an interesting question, because if I were to, from my heart of hearts, answer that, I would say abolish the Vatican, disband, sell all the wealth, and become humble Christians like Jesus Christ was, feed the poor, live as Christ lived, wandering and preaching, sell off the Vatican and really be Christians. And then we'll probably push a lot of buttons at what I've just said. But so that's me, John Hogue, my own spiritual path tells me saying what he ought to do. Now,
but don't you think?
I have to elaborate on that. Now, John Hoag, as a prophecy scholar, which is a different perception, would say that the Pope will have to take a more active role in what's going on in the Middle East. Perhaps what might be a great thing would be even him visiting Iran, visiting and speaking with the Ayatollah Khamenei, having some dialogue with the Ayatollah Council who really run Iran, and then going to Syria and talking to Bashar al-Assad. And there are many Christian communities in Syria, and trying to create a dialogue and rapport that he is a man who can be, just as John the 23rd was during the last significant crisis of equal possibility, the Cuban Missile Crisis. John the 23rd knew Khrushchev's brother, and through that relationship was able to play a role that's not often known in the Cuban Missile Crisis, that he had a lot to do with helping sending messages and things. It was a very bold thing for him to do because no one up to that time even spoke to communist leaders in the Catholic Church. It was considered a huge, you don't go there. He did it. And because of that, helped the dialogue, was in part helping the dialogue that avoided a thermonuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States in 1962. What we need is another John the 23rd dramatic moment. We need this Pope to actually go to the places where, if America is not going to talk to its enemies, let the Pope, a Christian, a vicar of Jesus Christ, talk to them, try to a true ecumenicalism that could at least open channels of dialogue and understanding.
John, we're up against another break. I'm going to, when we get back, I want to talk with you more about what may be coming in the next month as we go in from 07 into 08. And I also want to talk about some of the scientific discoveries, the search for the God particle, and how this might factor in of new knowledge that starts to wake people up and bring this new consciousness forward. This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. We'll be right back.
Don't miss John Hoag's great website, HoagProphecy.com, a free newsletter plus downloadable The Last Pope, only $7 at HoagProphecy.com.
Howdy, this is Jim Mars, and I'm speaking today with Christopher Jones, the translator of the Otto Rahn book, Crusade Against the Grail. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't tell you how excited I am. I was when I found out that there was an English translation of Otto Rahn's book.
He's talking about the legendary quest for the Grail that inspired Hitler's efforts to find the Holy Grail and the secret powers within it, and Otto Skorzeny's mysterious 1944 trip to Rahn-le-Chateau, where he telegraphed back to Berlin, "Mission successful." What did he mean? Listen to this fascinating interview with Chris Jones by Jim Mars in our subscriber section. Click on that subscribe tab today. Join us. It's well worth it.
Great. This is Dreamland. We're continuing with John Hoag. John, one of the suggestions that's made about the last pope is that this figure will be endowed with occult energies and have an ability to organize a stunning new world religion. It's likely that any new world religion that comes on the scene that would be capable of generating peace, because obviously the big three old religions are completely incapable of living or creating a peaceful civilization, that we're going to need some kind of a leader that has a connection to a deeper kind of consciousness than is displayed by any of the leaders presently on the world stage. Can we talk for a moment about that new consciousness that is going to be able to create this peace? And what are your thoughts on technological developments as a factor in the fulfillment of these prophecies?
Well, first, the technological steps that are happening in general are leading us towards something I've sensed in the distant future, probably not so distant, will be happening, just as up until just 100 years or so ago, we didn't know how to capture, even know that there existed radio waves and
right.
other things that are invisible to our normal senses. I do feel that we are within 50 years away from being able to measure and capture thought as much, because thought is like a wave, that there may be aspects about the soul that can be monitored, that in the next century, or maybe even sooner than that, maybe in the next 50 years, there will begin a revolution in spiritual science that allows the what the Tibetans have been doing for centuries in their bardo ceremonies, in their attempts to find people who have died, who have been reincarnated, might go to another step where I foresee a time in the prophecies of the new humanity, which are many, of a race of people who actually talk to souls before they're even in the birth chamber to decide who wants to come and be born by whom. And then at the same time, the life cycle, when it ends, does not end solely with the death of the physical body, but with a continued communication to help the person to either advance and dissolve into the seventh plane, or to advance to higher planes, or to use this wonderful, though strange and often travailsome gift of life in the physical body to advance their spiritual understanding through life experience, and then be drawn down into a new womb. That in these God particle issues and others that are happening now are the baby steps towards that glorious future. The thing that is keeping that from happening sooner are the religions that are currently suppressing humanity. My sense is, and I say this as a record on this show, that people of future centuries will hear and understand what I'm saying here, that the religions, as we call them, these religions that currently exist, if the day that they fade away is going to be the day that man is truly free to be religious. And right now, in the name of religion, people's unique consciousness is suppressed to follow slavishly dogmatic ideas. The very idea, people in the future will look back at us and say, how could they make their children, spoon-feed their children their views without, why didn't they let their children seek the mysteries and find them on their own and be just a gentle guide to allow them to do that? How can you make a person a Christian just because they're born a Christian? How can you make a person become a Muslim just because they happen to be born a Muslim?
And that's something Christianity boasts of, John, that 80% of Christians are converted before they're 18 years old.
80%. Well, you know, there are a billion Catholics, and most of them are born into Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
I think that information is interesting, but a little not quite correct. Yes, people can be. Well, let's look at an example of the American president. He was born a Christian. You know, when he was born in Kennebunkport, he didn't have the freedom to seek Hinduism or anything else. He was born in a Judeo-Christian mindset. Now, he also fell from the grace. That's also part of the Christian faith. He was a sinner. He was an alcoholic. He was doing coke. He was chasing women. He was having problems. And then finally, he was given the ultimatum from his wife, either me or Jack Daniels. And so he stopped drinking. He went to Christian friends, and he was born again. But all of that from birth is part of the cycle of being in a Judeo-Christian conditioning. He was born a Christian. You do think if he had been born a Muslim, that it would have been so easy for him to have the fall from grace and rise up again. It still was in the Christian context. He was a Christian sinner, become now a true Christian again. So when I hear people say that 80% of the people are converted into Christianity, I think that source is probably coming from people who cannot step back from their own conditioning as Christians and see
mm-hmm.
that the vast majority of people, and it's the same for any other religion, and I've been all around the world and seen how people just adopt like food from mother's milk the conditioning that you're born in a Hindu village, you are a Hindu. That has nothing to do with the soul in that baby's body actually knowing or understanding it. He is trained to borrow an idea of religion. And anything that's borrowed, anything that's not your intrinsic existential experience, is false, even if it was true for someone else. And that's a maxim that people in the future will live by. And they'll look in the context of that back at us and say, how did they cope? How can you spoon feed or program people to follow a religion? How can you not? Why did they make people be Christians when the whole point is to be a Christ? Why did they make people Buddhists rather than Buddhas? Why weren't Islamic followers, each and every one, a unique prophet of Allah, like Muhammad? And so on. So in the distant future, and I put this down on your show as a record, that if this record survives the coming times, I know from my own intrinsic truth that this prophecy will be fulfilled in a few hundred years by the people that will come after us, who have finally been fed up with the fundamental conspiracy that has overshadowed human religious growth, and that is our dogmatic, mechanical religions, which are not really the products of the founders of these religions. They're the products of the unenlightened people left behind, doing the best they can to decipher what their enlightened masters said. And, of course, in that process, it will only be politicized and egocentric, because short of our own enlightenment, that is how we live in this
world.
And when
you're talking about enlightenment, you're really talking, as you noted earlier, about the apocalypse. And in the book, you describe the Catholic apocalypse in four steps: the warning, the miracle, the chastisement, and the era of peace. Talk about that just for a moment, John, especially in the context then of the appearance then on the world stage of this figure who's called Petrus Romanus, the last pope.
Yes, the apocalyptic times begin, the tribulations begin with the current pope, who will probably live perhaps till next year, at the most maybe 2012, but his reign will probably be short-lived. That doesn't really take a prophet to predict that. He's the oldest appointed pope in history at 79. So his reign will not be long, just by the natural course of life. He will be followed then by Petrus Romanus. Now, in the final coda, Petrus Romanus is trying to feed the flock of the Christian church in tremendous tribulations. Now, that can be taken in two ways. Certainly, all the Catholic apocalypse will be full on by then. It can be taken in two ways. The phrase to feed the flock is give them the body and blood of Christ, to dispense the Holy Eucharist. That's the surface part of it, but in a deeper sense, it could be more literal in that the world foreseen by many prophets in an apocalyptic, in the negative sense, condition, is a world that can't sustain itself. It's a world that we're about to enter if we don't stop the climate change, if we don't stop the rising of oceans, if we don't stop this explosion of population that also believes that it can consume to abandon an illusion of infinite resources when there are none. This cannot survive long a world that's based on fossil fuels that is now suffering a peak oil and will now start a long decline in oil reserves. All of that equates to famine. Any one of those points leads to a breakdown of the super systems that keep the civilization going. And that, of course, immediately impacts the ability for, if the fuel is too expensive or non-existent, the food in the truck that comes to your local supermarket is not coming.
Right.
Just to give you a basic idea of that. So when you, if you start turning your crops in the breadbasket of the world into ethanol to feed your cars, half the world is going to go hungry, because if the food is not literally coming to them, it'll be so expensive, as food is getting very expensive, that poor nations in the developing world, in Africa and Asia, will not be able to buy food from the developed nations, and you will have major famine. Since most of the new Catholic realm is in the third world now, the shift away from Europe into the developing world of South America, Africa, and Asia, a near future Pope Petrus Romanus is going to definitely be overwhelmed with issues of how to literally feed his flock as well as give the Eucharist to his flock. And so because of that phrase, I think we're dealing with a near future situation. But here's the possible exclusion of that. Why isn't this man the 112th motto? Why is there 111 mottos and then Malachi's prophecy or the man writing under his name had the coda? Some people believe that Petrus Romanus is a true pope that will arrive after several false popes, that the final numbering of the current pope is done so because this is the end of time as we know it. This is the end of the succession. We're entering a period of chaos in the papacy where there may be a number of popes before Petrus Romanus appears that are false popes. We are entering with this pope's death the apostasy of the church that was foreseen in the Catholic apocalypse, where the coming popes may actually be servants of the Antichrist. I'm not completely sure that this current pope isn't one of them because of what he did to the Fatima prophecies as cardinal under the command of John Paul II. And that is basically produced what I think is a fraudulent third secret. That's apostasy, if I've ever seen apostasy of the church.
Some of the other signs that you know, John, are the rash of divine stigmata and other portents. People will be looking for signs. People will be converting to Catholicism in great numbers. And then you describe something called the chastisement, where God sends two final prophets, Elijah and Enoch. Talk about the role of these two figures and how they play together with that of Petrus Romanus.
Well, the prophecy doesn't really mention them at all, so it's hard to know if they play with him. I don't think either one is Petrus Romanus.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically the final messengers who are going to come around and say, this is the last chance, and then the real tribulation of the Antichrist, Armageddon, things happen. And I think they are martyred in the process. The thing then, if there is a biblical connotation to Petrus Romanus, is the fact that the prophecy calls him Peter of Rome. One thing that runs against is that no pope, it's an unwritten law, no pope can be named Peter, except for the first pope, who was St. Peter, the apostle, the first bishop of Rome. Now, there's some interesting things with that. Some people believe in Catholic circles that means that, like the first pope, the last pope will be a Jewish. And there was one candidate floated around during the last change of succession, who is the Archbishop of Paris, who started life as a Polish Jew and converted to Catholicism. Well, that was entertained, but no one thought that would be happening. So that may still happen in the future, as a Jew will become pope. The other possibility is that it's not a man; it's a man from Rome, but born from Rome. But he's not. His name is Pedro, Pietro.
Mm-hmm.
It's his Christian name. But he becomes another name. The other thing that can happen is there's no rule against the pope being called Simon, which is one of Peter's names. So a Pope Simon alludes to Peter, or it'll be a cardinal who has either served in a cardinalate or a bishopric that has symbols of Peter, the fisherman, the fisher's net, the boat, a fisher of soul. It could be a person who served in one of the many churches called St. Peter's. So these are the things to look out for when the day comes that this pope is interned and a new pope is chosen. And from that point then, I think the prophecy was at least poetically trying to say that with you started with a Peter, you end with a Peter, and which implies that the church does not survive the apocalypse, according to this St. Malachi prophecy, which is actually against the mainstream approved apocalypse of the church, which does not want to see itself destroyed, but actually resurrected and restored to be now the governing church and priesthood of the world. Now, there's an interesting prophecy from a renegade Catholic prophet, Joachim de Fiore, who was a near contemporary of St. Malachi and did actually write from back in medieval times. And his idea was that the evolution of the churches of the Bible and God's Word on the world runs in three 2,000-year periods. A 2,000-year period of the Old Testament, and then it evolved into the 2,000 years of the Son of God, the ministry of Jesus. And that we now, at this time, are entering the last 2,000-year period of the church, which is the church of the Holy Ghost. So it's the Father, the era of the Father, the Son, and 2,000-year era of the Holy Ghost, which is implied that it is a time when humanity does not need a middleman, a middle priesthood, to tell it what or commune prayers to God, that everyone will, it'll be like the world will, everyone will be a priest and priestess of the coming spiritual time, that God will speak directly to his people through the Holy Spirit that's in all of us.
The spiritual time. John, you know, unfortunately we've come to the end of our time, but that's the perfect note to leave our conversation on today. I want to thank you for dedicating all this time and your effort towards bringing us some light and some understanding of these very key and very very powerful prophecies. So thank you, John, very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, William.
This is William Henry. This is Dreamland. Next up, Linda Moulton Howe.
You can't go wrong supporting this great independent website. No outside advertising because you keep it that way. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com today. Because of you, we're free. Genetically modified crops, watch out. You're about to experience something you just can't get elsewhere. Emmy Award-winning science reporter Linda Moulton Howe reporting on the absolute leading edge of science, discovery, and the true mysteries of the unknown. Don't miss her website, earthfiles.com, the one science website that tells you the secrets and gives you the facts the others dare not. Earthfiles.com. This week, she's reporting on the damaging effects of genetically modified crops. Here she is from Albuquerque, Linda Moulton Howe.
Thanks, Whitley. 5 months ago, in October 2006, a Pennsylvania honeybee keeper discovered that 60% of his bee colony of 1,900 hives were empty. He contacted Penn State apiary experts to investigate. Since then, massive disappearances of honeybees have been reported in at least 22 states and internationally in Poland and Spain. By March 2007, dozens of scientists are trying to solve the mysterious honeybee disappearances, which are now being called colony collapse disorder, or CCD. So far, analysis of the few bees that have been found in the deserted hives show as many as five different viruses and unidentified fungi in the bees, implying something has seriously damaged those honeybee immune systems. And what could that be? Various agencies around the United States are trying to answer that question. So far, there are no answers, but there is a list of possible causes. On that list are pesticides and genetically modified crops. Even though scientists say there is no evidence that genetically modified crops, also known as GMOs or GMs, are linked to honeybee die-offs, the National Academy of Sciences had a meeting in 2006 about the alarming decline of pollinators throughout North America. Pollinators include honeybees, bumblebees, hornets, wasps, butterflies, hummingbirds, and even bats. Something has happened in the environment that is causing all of those different species to decline. And currently, the most dramatic event is the massive disappearance of honeybees. What changed in 2006? As I've recently interviewed more than a dozen scientists and government agency bee experts, I have begun to learn how much is not known about the accumulative impact on insects, animals, and even people of combinations of applied pesticides plus genetically engineered crops such as soy, cotton, and canola that have had a gene inserted into their DNA to produce pesticides systemically throughout the plants, or they have been genetically created so that they won't be killed by herbicide sprays that are sprayed on the plants to kill the weeds. Now, the largest manufacturer of all this is Monsanto. One pesticide by itself might not destroy honeybees, but what happens when farmers spray herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, and rodenticides around land that also has genetically modified crops with pesticides built in? How much is too much for Earth life? The United States now accounts for nearly two-thirds of all biotechnology crops planted around the world. Since 1996, the United States has consistently planted more GM crops than any other country. Total acreage of genetically modified corn, soybeans, cotton, and canola now in the United States in 2006 totaled 128.3 million acres, and that was an increase of nearly 10% more GMs planted than in 2005. In addition to large farming of soy, corn, cotton, canola, and alfalfa, other smaller GM crops now include zucchini, crooked-neck squash, and Hawaiian papaya. Meanwhile, data keeps piling up about human allergies and sick and dying animals and amphibians linked to interactions with GMs. One man is convinced the GMs should be eliminated from the world's agriculture. He is Jeffrey Smith, author of the best-selling book, Seeds of Deception. His follow-up book will be released in April with a title that he says sums up the situation in terms: Genetic Roulette. His subtitle is The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods. The foreword is written by Michael Meacher, former UK Environment Minister, who states, quote, "The case presented is absolutely a smoking shotgun that should stop in its tracks any dabbling with GM foods, whether by individual families, food companies, and indeed nations. Jeffrey Smith is the modern David against the GM Goliath. This book may well provide the slingshot to change the global course of events in this century," unquote. This week, I talked with Jeffrey Smith about some of the documented health risks to humans and animals and why genetically modified crops are different than naturally evolved crops.
When you create a genetically modified crop or organism, it's not like you're sticking in a Lego piece, you snap it into place. There's massive collateral damage that occurs within the DNA, and this can create unexpected side effects. And this comes from the process of inserting the gene as well as cloning the output through tissue culture. You can end up typically 2 to 4% of the entire DNA typically different than the DNA was to begin with. These involve mutations, deletions, rearrangements. Not only that, but a single insertion, according to one study, changed the expression levels of up to 5% of the genes in the DNA. We're talking about massive changes in the DNA sticking in one foreign gene. So this concept that it's a precise, well-ordered transformation is completely false, and it's the product of public relations, certainly not of science. So you have products of modification that have caused massive damage in rats that were fed these GM products, but it wasn't a specific protein that the gene was producing that caused problem. It was simply the process of creating the genetically modified crop that caused the massive damage, that caused the massive unpredicted changes, that caused the health effects in the animals. So that's one thing. The second is that you have a gene that produces a protein that is specific that's never before been part of that organism. You have the pesticide, for example, that you use to the cotton or the corn. The regulator claims this pesticide was safe because organic farmers have used it for years in its natural form and it has a safe use. They ignore entirely the fact that hundreds of people complained of allergic reactions when they were sprayed with it from a gypsy moth infestation. They ignored entirely the results of mice studies that showed an immune response equal to that of cholera toxin, abnormal and excessive cell growth, and other problems. They ignore the science selectively in order to claim that they don't need to test the fact that they're putting a pesticide in every bite. So you have the collateral damage on the one hand and the introduced protein on the other. But that protein might not actually be what you intend. When you stick the gene in, it can be truncated, mutated, rearranged, or the protein that's produced can be changed after it's expressed in a new organism. And they found, for example, these peas in Australia, they were supposed to have a completely identical protein to the natural one. It turns out it had a potentially deadly reaction. They had to stop the commercialization process. And what they found was a very subtle change in that they wouldn't have normally found through the normal studies. And this could be happening already with the foods on the market. Then you have the increased use of herbicides as a result of these herbicide-tolerant crops. About 80% of the crops that are genetically engineered are designed not to die when sprayed with herbicide. And this results in a much higher amount of herbicide use. In the first 9 years, there's about a 138 million pound increase in the use of herbicides in the United States. By 2004, it was estimated that there was about 86% more herbicides sprayed on Roundup Ready soy acres than non-GM soy acres. And what this means is it changes the whole soil composition, it increases the residues, in the, it increases the fungus in the soil, and it changes the whole ecosystem in ways that might be very dangerous. In fact, it might get into the groundwater that we may be drinking this herbicide. If you genetically engineer a crop with genes from bacteria, and so you're putting bacteria genes into corn and into soybeans, and you're knocking down the normal barriers to prevent one gene from one species to transfer into bacteria. So it's possible that we are populating our own bacteria in massive quantities by eating these genetically modified crops.
What is the strongest medical evidence that humans can be badly affected by genetically modified crops?
There's a lot of evidence. I've just spent about 2 years gathering all that evidence with input from more than 30 scientists into a book that's coming out in April called Genetic Roulette, the Documented Health Effects of Genetically Engineered Foods. There's very few studies on GMOs. I mentioned only one published peer-reviewed human feeding study. We know of a food supplement in the 1980s that was genetically engineered, and only that genetically engineered brand killed about 100 Americans and caused 10,000 to fall sick. And we've documented how information was withheld from the public and from Congress, which would have put the blame squarely on genetic engineering, but there was alternate explanations put forth with partial information that created a distraction. So that is one very strong piece of evidence that the process of genetic engineering can cause new diseases. We also know that soon after genetically modified soy was introduced to the UK, soy allergies skyrocketed 50%. We know that genetically modified soy has an increase of a known allergen called trypsin inhibitor. In fact, the cooked GM soy level was about 7 times the amount with this known allergen compared to a non-GM soy control. We know that when soybeans were fed to mother rats, the offspring died at a rate of about 56% in the first 3 weeks. When the mother rats were fed non-GM soy, the offspring died at a rate of only 10%. That's a huge and alarming finding. It's preliminary research, but in the same Russian institute where that occurred, they started introducing genetically modified rat chow to all of the housed rats, and within 2 months, the mortality rate for the entire institute was above 50% for the rat offspring, suggesting that this might be a general thing for genetically modified soy. In other animal research, they found that mice that were fed genetically modified soy had problems in the development of their sperm cells. And the offspring of those mice that were grass-fed GM soy, in the young embryos, there was a change in their gene expression. It wasn't seen in the embryos from parents who were fed non-GM soy. They saw potentially toxic reactions in the liver from GM soy, changes in the enzyme levels of the major organs in the body, all sorts of things indicating a massive response in the physiology of animals to the introduction of genetically modified soy.
How could so much evidence of some kind of harmful effect from genetically modified crops be essentially dismissed? And I say that because clearly GMO crops are being grown and are increasing around the world.
Well, I've documented in my first book, Seeds of Deception, the ways in which that evidence has been suppressed. For example, a UK government-funded study found that the process of genetic engineering is most likely the culprit causing massive damage in rats that were fed GM potatoes. They had potentially precancerous cell growth in the digestive tract, smaller brains, livers, and testicles, partial atrophy of the damaged immune system. When the scientist went public with his concerns, he was fired from his job after 35 years and silenced with threats of a lawsuit. His 20-member research team was dismantled, and they gagged him and would not allow him to respond and then put out all sorts of disinformation.
Who was doing the threats and the fire?
He was working for the prestigious Rowett Institute in Scotland, and he was working on a $3 million grant from the government, and he was asked to speak on television. Information from his director, he did a short interview, and for 2 days after the interview, he was a hero at his prestigious institute, and then about 2 days later, two phone calls were allegedly placed from the UK Prime Minister's office, forwarded through the receptionist to the director of the institute, and the next morning, that director fired Dr. Arpad Gustay. Now, this type of treatment is not unique. I've talked to many, many scientists who were kicked out. I interviewed, for example, a scientist from the FDA who was doing the evaluation of Monsanto's bovine growth hormone. He was asking for more studies and concerned about the approval process. He was kicked out. So there's a whole tradition of muzzling scientists and distracting and fighting against what would normally be evidence to stop production.
What is the argument that genetically modified crops better than natural crops?
Farmers cross through natural selection one species with another in order to combine traits. They'll combine a disease-resistant plant with a high-yield plant to try and get a high-yield resistant plant. So with GM, what you can do is you can take a single gene where you have characterized a single trait and add it so you don't have to go through a period of sometimes years with thousands of plants in order to introduce a particular trait. But what you're doing is you're crossing the species barrier, and this is made clear, for example, in some of the odd combinations. They've taken a spider gene and put it into a goat and hopes to milk the goat for spider web protein in order to make bulletproof vests. They've put jellyfish genes into pigs so that the pig's nose glows in the dark. They've put human genes into corn to create spermicide, and they put pesticides into corn so that there's pesticides in every bite. Now, these combinations are putting genes in, have not evolved as part of the years of evolution, and the process of insertion causes damage. The introduction of these new proteins and new genes could cause unpredicted side effects. But what they end up getting is a corn that produces its own pesticide, and that they get to patent, and they get to sell as a pesticide-producing product. But they don't do the necessary work to verify that the foods are safe for consumption. And if you look at what they actually do, the studies are so poorly designed. Actually, I would say they're brilliantly designed to avoid finding problems. That it would have to be an acute poison with an instant result in order for some of these industry-funded studies to show any health risks. And yet, sometimes they still do. We still end up with incredible symptoms in some of these animals that have been fed GM crops.
It sounds as if these Frankenstein approaches to making genetically modified crops could be reducing the biodiversity of plants on the earth. If we depended on GMO crops, we might end up with crops that could be killed easily by one thing, and we would not have biodiversity to back up our food supply.
Genetic engineering of the food supply is very dangerous for food security. It's very dangerous for biodiversity. In Argentina, where there are millions and millions of acres of genetically modified soy, someone who was there told me it's like a desert. There are no insects. There are no leaves of other plants. It's just like a factory to produce soy. And it is destroying the ecosystem, and the overuse of these herbicides is also causing real serious problems in human health and also in environmental health.
It's like dominoes falling from an unknown hand in an unknown pattern with an unknown end result.
You really get it. You really get it. That's why my book is called Genetic Roulette. You spin it, you don't know where it's going to land, but it has huge consequences when it does. The process of putting a gene into the DNA, it's like throwing a dart. There's 2 billion different ways it can land. When it goes in, it can knock out genes at random, turn them off permanently, turn them on permanently, rearrange things. And you have no idea what it's actually doing because we don't know that much about how the DNA orchestrates this massive complexity of the organism. And so we just have rudimentary knowledge, the infant stages. It's a very serious situation.
Jeffrey Smith's new book, Genetic Roulette, The Documented Health Risks of Genetically Engineered Foods, will be released in April 2007, and orders can now be taken at geneticseedsofdeception.com. The book will also be available later in bookstores. So, Whitley, where Monsanto and Norvadis and these large corporations are pushing the idea that there is something better in having genetically modified crops that include even pesticides built into the genomes. After 10 years of expanding those crops on this planet, becoming very clear that on another side of the scale, that medical data, scientific data is beginning to add up, that everyone should pause and say, do we really want these kinds of genetically modified crops growing on this planet and now contaminating non-GMO crops?
Oh, Linda, this has to be one of the scariest you've ever done, because those bees are dying in billions. And, you know, I have an image in my head. It's the Monsanto campus. There's not a single thing moving anywhere inside the skeletons of people who have starved to death, just like all of the rest of us. And you know what's left? Their bank accounts are all full of the billions of dollars they collected in the process of killing mankind.
Well, in this honeybee issue, it is still a huge mystery. There is absolutely nothing that links the honeybee disappearance to the genetically modified crops. But what is beginning to emerge in all these interviews that I've done is what are cumulative effects of all these layers of pesticides and herbicides and systemic pesticides within GMO crops, and what is the cumulative effect if you genetically create crops that are supposed to resist herbicide sprayed so that the herbicide kills off all of the weeds. And now what they're finding, Whitley, is that the weeds that are beginning to grow in these GMO fields are resistant to the herbicide. So what happens? The farmer puts on more and more.
And more. Linda, we are reaching the point of no return. We have got to say goodbye now, folks. This has been Dreamland. Whitley Strieber, Linda Moulton-Howe, we've had a great time, and I really do wish that we had been able to bring you better news about this. But do keep up with this on unknowncountry.com. We follow the genetic foods controversy closely. We'll be talking to you again next week. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.